Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host of Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We will be discussing today many issues in America which has resulted in the downfall of individuals in prison, communities, on the streets, in the homeless shelters, and beyond. We have back on with us today Jennifer Mather and Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapists from the Netherlands, and Jennifer Mather from the United States, psychologist and psychotherapist. Okay, Jen, I'm going to ask you this time to tell the audience a little bit about yourself and what you are doing, and Mariam, can you follow after her, please?
My name is Jennifer Mather. I'm currently a volunteer with the new organization, and I am formerly a therapist. I was a therapist in Massachusetts, and I also did research for Boston University. I worked with juvenile offenders, and I worked with the courts in Massachusetts and did assessments and for placement and risk assessments with young offenders. And I did research for domestic violence and family violence for Boston University as an undergrad and graduate student. And I'm currently getting back into the workforce. And as I said, volunteering with the New Vision organization and working with as an advocate for incarcerated individuals.
Thank you so much, Jen. And also, Mariam, can you talk a little bit about yourself? And then I'm going to turn the show over to both of you. I just received a call from Cape Cod, and I need to respond to it. So if you can, Mariam, talk about what you are doing, what you're about, which many people already are familiar with you and getting familiar with Jen, Jennifer Mather. But can you tell a little bit about yourself, and then the two of you can have the show for a while. I'm going to shut my mouth. Thank you so much, yeah. Both of you.
Okay, you shut your mouth, Leona. Well, I come from the Netherlands, so the things that I do is mostly in the Netherlands. I am a psychosocial therapist, and I work as a volunteer in a Dutch prison system. I have done research. Wait a minute. I have done for my master philosophy. I done research on mass incarceration in the United States, and I wanted to understand if there are similarities of in patterns between the concentration camps at World War II and in the United States prison system. And I had this question because in 2002, I visited Auschwitz, and about 4 years ago, I was in the prison system in Florida, and well, I felt the same thing, and I wanted to know what it was, what I felt, if that was right or a misinterpretation. So I did this research, and I wrote my thesis about it, and now I am transforming my thesis into a little book that I want to publish and also translate in English and publish. It was a very difficult research, also emotionally, but I saw I saw some similarities that underlie both systems, and I think it can be contribute to more insight in what are we talking about when we talk about mass incarceration in the United States. In a week I will start in my pre-master religious studies. Religion is also involved in both systems and in underlying patterns of both systems. So I'm very curious about this study. And that's my story, partly.
Okay.
Yeah, I cannot talk quickly because my brain is always translating from Dutch to English, so that takes time.
That's impressive, actually. All right. So I guess we're here to talk about mass incarceration today.
Yeah, I would like to know from you, if you don't mind.
No.
You have been in the prisons in Massachusetts, is that right?
I worked with the juvenile system. So I worked with them before they went to adult prison. And so I worked with them on a younger level. And so what I did was I would get children who committed serious crimes and determine what the best placement was. And I think it was actually a more, it's more of, I wish they did more of it in the adult system. But, you know, based on what they did, we determined whether or not the best place for them was to return into society. Was it to return into long-term residential? Was it to go to a Department of Youth Services facility and then transition afterwards? And so it depended a lot on an assessment period and, you know, a lot of therapy and depending on what they did, because a lot of them were social services referrals, court referrals to determine basically, you know, were they even competent at the time that they did what they did. Some of it was age. Some of the kids were very young when they did some serious, pretty serious offenses. And to look at trauma, to look at what went on to make them do what they did. You know, we're talking very young kids who committed things like, you know, homicide, sex offenses, fire setting, that sort of kind of things. Fire setting with their parents in the beds. very serious offenses. And, you know, what was the likelihood of them doing it again? Was it a first time? Was it, you know, a fifth time? And what was the likelihood of them, you know, being able to be rehabilitated and, you know, based on age, based on, you know, were they aware of what they did and was it wrong? And do they know the difference between right and wrong? You know, what's society's view of it versus what's the child's perspective of it? A lot of these kids were, at the time, we had a crack epidemic and these were crack babies. And that's a huge... Back then, I mean, this was in the 90s, so these kids were born in the 80s, and that was a big problem back then. And so developmentally, were they ever going to be able to appreciate their actions? Because if you look and you look at brain scans of these kids, you know, did they have fully developed, you know, with their brains, what they should be? So, you know, you had to look at that, and you had to, there's a lot of factors that you had to look into.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so in sitting down with the kids and talking to them, when they talk to you and they, you know, some of it was learned, some of it, they didn't realize that they'd been in families where, for example, if you sat down with a child offender, this was something that if they grew up in a house where that was common, they didn't even realize what they were doing was wrong. Because that's something that's been going on in their house forever. And that's, they didn't know any better. Versus somebody who was angry and acted out as an anger offense. So you had to look at every offense differently. You had to, you know, again, it was something that everything was different. Everything happened for a reason. And therefore, the likelihood of what they were going to go out and do in the future really depended on why they did it to begin with. And everything was case by case. And I think that translates into the adult system. And people don't take enough time to look at what got them there. I mean, unless they were have a lengthy juvenile history, what got them there, what is going to, you know, and how to stop it from happening again in the future.
And were there enough possibilities to place them in the right place to give them the right treatment? How is it arranged? Because I know there's things like, I don't know how it is like social services, I believe. There is a lot privatized and there is a lot closed.
It depends what who is funding it. And that most of the, I remember when I first started working, you had, I couldn't understand why people would give their kids up to the state. And that was a very confusing topic for me. Like, I couldn't comprehend it. And over time, I understood it because the state then, if their child becomes a ward of the state then pays for the services, social services pays for it, the Department of Mental Health, that's cost share, you know, and Department of Ed pays for their education, Department of, you know, Social Services pays for, everybody sits down and has a meeting, and that was part of my job too. I was a coordinator, and so we would sit down and everyone would pay a portion, and that's the state paid for it, and as opposed to private insurance is paying for it, because that wasn't going to happen. But I couldn't understand when you first get out of graduate school and you go to work and you're like, why would people want to get their kids a social worker? And why would they want to give up their parental rights? Like, I couldn't figure that out. And then over time I figured it out. When your kid needs that much help, you know, sometimes you don't have a choice. When you're afraid to have your kid in your own home, or, you know, you learn a lot, and it's stuff they don't teach you in school. Like,
yeah, I understand. Yeah,
stuff you learn it on the job. Like,
yes, exactly. It's nice to have all these education and all these studies.
Exactly.
But life, the biggest lessons are in life itself. You cannot learn them. You know, I always say to my kids, I have four kids, and I always say, none of my kids are written in books, you know. I have to figure myself out as a parent, and they have
exactly.
to figure themselves out as a person. And do kids have room to do so? That's the big question.
Exactly.
Because I can understand in your work what you did is that I think the big thing is that kids, you know, the way of raising has to be restored. Something went wrong if you grow up with certain values, and those values are negative, then these kids, you know, for them it's daily life. So they have to be helped with, you know, learning new values, and it's a kind of raising children while they are in a juvenile center.
Well, I think a lot of it is they don't have structure, and they don't know when they're going to eat next, and they don't have any rules or role models. And some of it I found was very comforting when they got into that sort of setting, to have to know that they're going to get three meals a day. They're going to, and they would act out and they would do things just to make sure you were watching them, because that was the first time that anyone noticed that they cared. Someone cared if they did something wrong. Someone cared if they, you know, and they would test you, and you know, and you would ask why, and they said, because you notice. No one's ever cared. No one's ever noticed. And it
so
was
so that's new. That's new for them.
Yeah, and you know, to be 14 or 15 years old and have someone actually care, and I think that that's some of the reason why we have adults even that go back to a lifestyle that get them incarcerated, because it's the consistency and the familiarity of knowing that they're going to eat three times a day and knowing that somebody is watching them. It's a comfortable, it's the consistency and it's the familiarity and it's the structure, and it's sad, but it's knowing that that's there.
Yeah, I can understand that for some people, in prison, they are assured that they can survive when you think about eating, sleeping, and all that. I mean, the outside world is far more complicated.
Exactly, and it's sad, which is why I think, you know, like at least in a residential facility, you know, they have some more freedom, but there's some people I think that, I know that when I worked in the hospital setting, there was people who knew that they were going to get released, and they would sabotage release because they were so afraid to be let out, and they wanted the comfort of knowing that they had staff to talk to 24 hours a day, and they had, if they were having a hard time, or they were having, you know, a rough day, or they were having anything, that they had something to fall back on. And
but they then what comes up in me is, this is really specifically this part, what you are describing now, is really a social problem. It's not a personal problem, but it's a social problem.
It is, absolutely.
You have, yeah, so you have, you know, you have like trauma or psychological, psychiatric disorders or whatever, or addiction. Okay, those are personal problems, but what you describe is a social problem. So
yes,
they reflect society and, you know, the lack in society. Society lacks, you know, this way of, you know, raising up people. You, not only the parents do that, you know, society does it too. Schools, teachers,
yeah,
you know, you name it.
But so I think it's a, there would be less people in prison,
yeah,
if there was more of that, then they wouldn't go to the extreme to get themselves in prison if they had that middle ground.
Yeah, I think it also has to do, I'm not sure, of course, because these are such nuanced issues, but I can imagine that part of it is, part of that problem stems from the fact that in your country everything is heavily privatized. And the social, you know, here in the Netherlands, we have more interference from governments. Not that the government decides what we should do. It's not communism, because
yeah,
I say this because a lot of American people think, you know, they are afraid of communism. You know, that goes back far to history. But that's not what we have. We could use our schools, our doctors, everything.
Mm-hmm.
But we have this, you know, base of that we always know that we have to, you know, we have food. For instance, I am a homeowner, and for two
mm-hmm.
years I was unemployed. I got money from social services,
yes,
but I didn't lose my home. So
yes,
I didn't end up in the street. Now I have a job, but for 2 years,
yes,
and I pay taxes for that. So
yes,
my community helped me, in fact, by paying taxes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they helped me indirectly. So I could get money from the government
mm-hmm.
and stay in my home. And now I pay tax, you know, now I have a job. So if somebody else has this problem, he or she is also helped. That means that my kids, I mean, if I would not have that, I think that if I would have lived in your country, I would have lost my home.
No, and probably.
And I think I would have ended up in the streets with my four kids.
No, God.
I have four children.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's that social problem, I think,
mm-hmm.
what you see, what these children in the juvenile centers reflect.
Yes.
They mirror that problem, you know. It's, I do understand that a lot of Americans want this freedom to do it all by themselves. And in your country, people are used to, you know, lose everything and then start all over again and do it again and sometimes and multiple times in their lives. So it is a choice. But it also gives all these problems because, you know, well, I must say it's a comforting. I don't think my country is better than yours. It's just another country.
It's
you know,
a different way of living.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's pros and cons to both, but I think it's just a different way of living. And I don't, yeah.
But you know, I think that what you described as problem,
yeah,
partly stems from those choices.
Yes.
But, you know,
there is, you have
Jen
a lot of,
Jen also mentioned role models, which is lacking in this country. Now, Marion, you talk about helping one another, the community and everything where you are. One of the things is with the role models in the prisons, people are lacking role models on the outside in the United States. But and it should be the same. It should be role models in the inside where they're supposed to be under correction. Now, I had a case this morning where the family member was asking for everyone to call the Department of Corrections because her son was has been paroled, and he was paroled specifically because he's been taking he's been going for his bachelor's at Emerson College while in prison. And so they paroled him early to register to finish his remaining Emerson College bachelor's classes before August 31st. He has to be enrolled by August 31st, and now they're not going to let him out until September 1st, a day after, which is going to cause him to fall back. this is where we lack role models within the penal system.
Yeah.
And in the communities as well. Now, Jen, you were talking about the lacking of role models, and Mariam's talking about how people help out where she comes from. I just had to put that one out there because sometimes the role models should start with organizations like social services, like the correctional department, things like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm sorry, I cut you
off. I think what you see in the correctional institutions, you know, when young people who are seeking, who don't know, who have never learned the values, the norms, values in life, then prison can feel safe for them, because in the prison that you see the same lack of role models, you know, a shortage of role models, and the approach which is, you know, distant, violent often. They are used to that, so they keep this pattern of violence, you know, keeps being maintained. So the prison system is like an extension of what happens in a lot of communities. So somewhere that circle, you know, it's a complete circle that starts, you know, when somebody is born, and especially in poor communities or minority groups, and when they end up in prison, you know, the same cycle maintains. Nobody breaks a cycle, and that's what I said earlier. You know, when you think about rehabilitation in a prison system, that's not about programs. That's about the daily approach from morning till the evening.
I agree with you. If you want somebody to be successful, you have to make them confident enough to be successful. And that starts, if it starts in the prison system, it should be a goal from day one. You know, what can we do to make you a better person on the outside? And it is with training, if it involves staff, it involves everybody, because you don't want recidivism. You don't want people to be more comfortable in the prison than out of the prison. I mean, and that's a fact. I mean, you want people to do their time, want to be out, but not want to be out because the people in there are horrible. You want them to want to be out because they want to be a contributing member of society and be a better person than they were before they got there. And, you know, think of how can I better myself and better my community, not, you know, I want to stay here because it's a more comfortable place, and not more comfortable because the people are nice, and not more comfortable. I mean, you want that to be a fact, but I want to look at the people. I want to emulate these people. I want to be a better person than I am. And you want them to get out and, you know, learn how can I better myself and better society.
But I think it starts with that people should get the opportunity to invent themselves again.
Yeah.
You know, just as being who they are behind a crime, an addiction, or whatever.
Exactly.
Sometimes they even don't know themselves anymore. So I think, you know, everybody is born good, but good or bad is already, you know, a judgment. I think somebody is who he is. And I think that who he or she is, people in prisons should have the opportunity to find it out again. Who was I originally?
Exactly. It should be a wake-up call and a chance to, you know, reinvent yourself and start over, you know. And, you know, you have an opportunity. You're given an opportunity to reinvent yourself and to give yourself a second opportunity. And they should be given especially if you know you have a release date, and, you know, you should take every opportunity to, you know, try to do what better yourself. And the staff should be treating you respectfully and supporting that as well. Like, how can we help make you better and make you a better person? And it should be that sort of approach. So you don't end up back here again. Like, let's work on this. And I mean, I think that goes to staff training as well. And, it, the approach has to be different.
I think making them late, like if P gets released on September 1st, the deadline is August 31st. I mean, this is ridiculous because why would they give him early parole so he can finish the class and then cause him to be late for the
that
class?
Makes no sense.
So that he's not, and, you know, where I feel they should invest all the money is not into the prisons but into the programs. As you both mentioned, before they get in trouble, before they go in, invest more money into programs, facilities on the outside to prevent crime, because we see crime is escalating all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
All over the country.
Yeah, but I also think that a lot is criminalized. That, you know, that in your country, little offenses already get, criminalized and heavy sentences.
In the Netherlands, we
keep the sentences as short as possible. Sometimes we can't if somebody is and maintains a danger. As I told last week, we also have people with a life sentence, but that's not because of the revenge or punishment, but that's because that person shows that he has no insight and he maintains being a danger. So that's another intention, another approach.
Yes.
But we also have to do with two agendas. You know, we here are talking about rehabilitation, what do incarcerated people need, but we shouldn't forget that there is also this level, the corporal level, that needs prisons full because, you know, it's making money. It's doing business. How many people, if you look at this organization, the Innocent Project, how many cases are there that people are proven to be innocent, everything is proven, and still they have to wait 10 years, 20
yep.
years. Last week I have participated in a documentary. Leona, you know that. There was one of four portraits of European women interacting with an American incarcerated individual. One of these men was on death row in Texas. He has a whole team and an organization behind him because it's proven that he did not commit a crime. It was the crime was killing two people. It was a setup. A friend of him got 30 years, so he gets out, but it turns out that he committed the crimes, but he had a deal.
Plea bargain.
Yeah, so he had a very smart deal, and this man ended up on death row. Now, about 6 months ago, he got released. There's even a Dutch lawyer who moved to Texas to help him. She lives there now. So he got out about, I think, 6 months ago or something, from death row into freedom. He was on parole. The organization provided him in an apartment. He even got a job, which is a whole thing because it's normally very difficult. He did exactly what he followed the rules. And now he's caught again. And now they have set a bail on $5 million, which nobody can pay. Yeah, maybe can Kim Kardashian. So... you know, the prison system, you know, uses its power play, but in fact, it stems from fear. If we try to change the system, we try to change the billion-dollar industry. That's a big fear. Recently, I have did some research for my book, and it was about racism from day one when the first colonists came. I will not tell you the whole story, but I see the same pattern. The colonists were already afraid for the slaves, you know, and there was already profit and money involved. In fact, nothing has been changed since 1600. When you look at patterns, you know, they changed the code on the outside, but beneath that code, under that code, it's the same. And that's what you see here too, with all these people who are incarcerated innocent, proven to be innocent, and they still are incarcerated. It's amazing. It's really flabbergasting, you know, if I read those stories.
Yeah. We have a caller. Oh, I'm sorry. 704, would you like to state your name, please? Maybe they're just listening in. Okay. Go ahead, Marion. I'm sorry.
Well, I think that's what I find interesting, also painful, but that I always see two levels. The levels of the, you know, reformers, and they are needed, but there's also that other level, which is so difficult. In fact, we should, you know, get more insight in how they play that game. It's so huge. It has to do with lobbying, politics, you name it. And what's the right answer to that huge game that is played? I don't know yet, but it is difficult.
Yeah, I don't know why it takes so long, like especially with people who've been found to be innocent, especially the numbers are huge at this point, especially with DNA, like to exonerate it. Even once you've been proven, it takes a long time to get the release date. I don't get that period.
Really?
And then the psychological damage that's been done when people have been sitting for 20, 30 years innocent in prison is, I mean, it's damage done. That blows my mind, especially like there's a lot of people.
I think it's a whole system. It's because also if you look how what kind of tactics they use.
Yeah.
Especially with young people, you know, when they ask, how do you say that? All these questions about where where were you at the time of the crime? What's that called? The hearing.
Alibi. Preliminary hearing.
Yeah, I think when somebody's arrested and he gets questioned. Yeah. Well, if you sometimes see these tactics, when I've seen it many times now, and I think for all these people who are innocent, incarcerated in the system, for sure, so many guilty people, dangerous people are walking in the streets because right ones, the really guilty ones, have not been caught. That's another thought that I thought that's scary, you know, if it happens sometimes, but it seems, you know, to be regularly.
I think people are a little more careful now. I think when it comes to pressing charges, when it comes to indicting people, because of the lawsuits involved with innocent people being convicted, because it does cost, once the person is released, they cost the courts a lot of money in lawsuits for wrongful incrimination. So I know, like, for example, even if they know pretty much who may have committed something before, especially if it's in a high profile case, before they name somebody as a suspect, before they press charges, they're a lot more careful. They've been in recent years to name names, to formally press charges because of fear of loss. Because people watch so much TV now, and they call it like the CSI effect. People are juries are much more aware of DNA and, two people at a scene, someone naming the other, so much back and forth. And so juries are a lot more aware of, investigation tactics and that sort of stuff. So I think now it's a little more difficult to get a wrongful conviction than it was, let's say, 10 years ago, because people are much more aware of the science behind investigations and how it's all done. It's all out there. Like, you can go look that stuff up on the internet. You can Google it. And people are more informed and more aware than they used to be. And juries are more informed and more aware. And it's harder to prove. And people question things more than they used to. And so I think in that regard, people who are less likely to get a wrongful conviction now, than 5 or 10 years ago, which is a good thing.
Yeah. But
you still have all the people that were wrongfully convicted that need to get exonerated. And those things are packing up. I mean, those cases there's numerous. I think there's almost too many, and it's overwhelming for the people that have to go through all those files and take care of those cases. But because there's so many that are, 20 and 30 years old to go through, and there's not enough bodies to do it. So, which is unfortunate and problematic, but it's reality. I don't think there's just the people and the time and the labs, and it's, the money, like who pays for all that? And, you know, I think that's part of the problem. If you're in prison and you have no money, who's going to pay for the, you know, who's going to pay for the testing? And who's going to, you know, we have all this financial problem. Again, it goes back to money.
Yeah, that's sad. But it then goes, you know, that money is more important than human life.
Yeah.
But that's not only in the United States. I think that's a worldwide problem. That's why we have all these issues now, with environmental issues and all that.
Yeah.
So we really make really wrong choices, I think.
Yeah.
And you see that back in the system.
Yeah. That stuff is costing less and less money now than it used to, but I think to expedite it, it all takes time. And again, once again, it's a people, you still have stuff going on now that needs to get done, and then you have to backtrack. And I think it's just, you know, time and money.
Mm-hmm.
America is
a big thing.
America is in a crisis, and changes need to be made. Somehow we need to come together and try to figure out how to make these changes. But as you mentioned, Mariam, it's all about money. You know, I just recently heard on the news the other day that the conservatives have made one of the biggest contributions, I guess, to the Republican race that's coming up or whatever. They said it was the biggest donation that they've made in history. So money, it's like people are buying their positions these days.
Yeah.
It's gotten out of control.
Yeah, and then it has nothing to do with skills anymore, but with money.
Exactly. Who you know.
Somebody should be, voted for his or her skills. But now it's so entangled. Economy and politics are so intertwined. You know, I told last year about, that organization ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, where big corporations and politicians work together, and corporations write model laws and which are sometimes or many times implemented. So then you can ask who writes the laws, the bills. Is it economy or is it politics? That's what happened, back then years ago with the Stand Your Ground law that I believe it's now abolished again. But that came from ALEC, and that's scary,
Can you talk a little bit more about that again, Mariam? I remember you brought that up once before, ALEC. Can you repeat that and just kind of like let everybody know more about that again?
Yeah, what I found out then, I read about it, is that it is an organization where people, big corporations and politics come together. And at that time, I don't know how it's now, but at that time, like the NRA was a member and Securus was a member and other corporations that are also involved in mass incarceration were members. And, together they write laws and they send them to certain states as a proposal and many times. And then, money is involved because the politicians are also part of ALEC. Many times those model laws got accepted by the state and then implemented. And at that time, I remember it was Florida, you had to Stand Your Ground law it meant that you have to write to defend yourself, shoot somebody to defend yourself, not only in the house, but also on the streets. And then there was this case about this young black boy who, went from school to home, and it was this white man, he followed him, and then he shot him. But, in court he said, well, I felt threatened by this boy, so I killed him. And then he didn't get any consequence of it. That was, I don't know how many, it's not so long ago, it's a few years ago. I believe that in Florida that law is abolished again because it's very subjective. If you say, if you walk on the street and you say, hey, I feel threatened, it's a feeling, Yeah, you can always have an excuse to, shoot somebody and then say, hey, I had to defend myself. That's very dangerous. But that law stems from ALEC, the cooperation between corporal power and politicians. And it still exists, still is there. And the more, I believe there are more of these organizations. Well, we know it. we know about corporal power around all the prisons. We know what it costs, you know, when we take a phone call from prison, you know, from a loved one in prison, or it's ridiculous.
What are your what are your thoughts on when there was an incident on television the other day where this three police officers were brutally beating this young man in, I believe it was Arkansas, and it was some lady across the street was telling them to stop, but she was filming the whole thing. They were kicking him in the head and the leg, and so there's an investigation going on now, but they're on paid leave. What are your thoughts about these things when law enforcement or whoever it is caught on video and you're seeing them doing something they shouldn't be doing to be put on paid leave? It's like going on vacation while they're being investigated. I can't understand why that would happen. It's still the taxpayers' money going into these.
I wouldn't speak unless I saw the whole incident, like not what I think the media sometimes shows clips and parts. So, I mean, I can't speak to the whole incident of it. I mean, I don't know what the media can be one-sided. So, I mean, I can say there's been incidents where if you saw the entire thing and maybe they didn't show the guy fighting back. So until I know the whole story, I wouldn't be able to comment on that. They probably shouldn't. I mean, the media has a tendency to show the worst. And so I don't know if I could say they should be on paid leave or shouldn't be on paid leave. I know if it turns out that they're guilty of something, they usually take the paid leave away and they lose their money and they end up getting sued somewhere down the line. So the paid leave ends up not being very rewarding to them in the long run. Regardless, the media has a way of making it look one way, and it could be the media's right or it could be the media's very wrong. But until the whole story comes out, like I try not to even make a judgment on it just because I've seen it go both ways.
But you know what the thing is, if you type in Arkansas police beating a single man,
I'll look it up right now.
Yeah, they show the video. They have it all over the internet. And it says three Arkansas officers suspended after video captures.
Oh, they got suspended. Yeah. I haven't seen it. I'm going to look it up right now. But
I don't think it was a racial thing because I'm looking, I don't know if the person, it doesn't look like the person was of color, but it was a brutal beating. But these are things that, to me, it's when they do have things like this, they shouldn't be. I mean, if anybody in the community, the average citizen, were to be caught gang, you know, jumping on one person as a gang, they wouldn't be getting leave from their job. They would be getting fired.
Yeah, they'd be suspended. But I'm looking at it right now, actually.
Yeah.
And but
there's so many things going on.
What I think is, you know, sometimes you hear it also of, you know, about guards in prison who beat up, an individual just with no reason. If that happens, then I think a guard should go through the same process as the incarcerated individual. I would want to know what's your issue, what's your trauma, what's your disorder, where does your aggression stem from? What's going on with you? Why? Because it's the same behavior as somebody who commits a crime at the street. That's also, you know.
Exactly.
So I think what should be done is, from what I understand, but now I'm not talking about police, I'm talking about guards, is that they have, I believe, about 6 weeks training.
That's
instead
it.
Of 2 or 3 years education, psychologically. And that's only, you know, a kind of a military training. So if such a person has his own personal issues, I mean, you cannot figure it out in 6 weeks' time.
Exactly.
And I think the environment of prison, if you are already damaged as a guard in your own youth, you are damaged as a guard in a way, and you are going to work in that system, it only feeds the aggression, or maybe, you know, you have a you have a feeling of retaliation against certain, you know, people from your youth, and you are, you know, you are, how do you say that, express that to the inmates, to the people in prison. So in fact, I wonder if the position of guard and incarcerated individual is that different. They are all in the same rotten system.
Exactly. And not only
and
that, they're all...
It's the system itself that appeal to violence if you are not stable. That's inherent to the system itself. The system is arranged that way, I think.
Just like these producers that put on all these violent movies, people love it. People will pay all kinds of money to go to the movies to see violence when, in fact, the movies are being, they're coming from the streets. They're coming from all the violence that goes on in the communities. Just like the wars that go on overseas, they put them in movies. And if you get people that have psychological issues watching these movies, it's only going to escalate. It's only going to get worse. But we have to look at people in uniform as they're human beings like everybody else, and everybody has their issues. Just like the courts. I say this all the time. As a social worker, we used to have 30 days to complete an assessment when we got a case. 30 days. You cannot have a court case that lasts 5 business days and then send somebody to the death row or prison for life. You have to give them more than a week. You have to give them at least 30 days to have these court cases to determine every aspect of crime. It doesn't happen. Jan, you know.
Exactly. You have 30 days, and then sometimes it's 60 to 90, depending on what the situation is. Like, you would have 30 days, and then you would determine, wait, this person needs a longer assessment period, and I'd get them for another 30 to 60 days. So,
exactly.
You know, depending on the situation.
When they do these internal investigations in the prisons, when there's crime, they do these internal investigations, and they're usually within a week or two, they dismiss the charges against their employees.
I'm reading it right now, so I just read. And, I mean, these sound like serious charges at this point, because I would think at this point they would be dismissed without pay, because the FBI is doing an internal investigation, and the Department of Justice is called in. So I would think at this point they would be dismissed without pay. And
when they showed it on television, it was...
I'm looking at it, yeah. Huh. And the police department is calling it, let me use their exact quote, violent arrest. They're using excessive force. That's what the police department is calling it. So I would think if the police department's calling it excessive force, then you would think that they would be without pay at that point. And, you know, talking about them retaining legal services, I would think at that point, you know, there's no more, we are putting on paid leave. I would think at that point we are terminating your contract.
Exactly. That's why I say people are human beings. And just because they have a title or they have a uniform doesn't exclude them from being offensive or being violent. Unfortunately, a lot of people in this country, it's a stressful country, are under a lot of stress, whether they're living in the streets or whether they're living in the White House. And this is what causes a lot of violence as well. And people have to stop looking at the titles and the uniforms, and they have to look at the individuals themselves.
But I think when you're wearing a uniform or have a title, you're sort of held to a higher, you should be held to a higher standard. People look up to you.
That's how we were raised. My parents, we had to respect the police. We had to respect the post office. And we had to respect our teachers. If we came home from school and we did something wrong in school, whether we didn't do anything wrong or we did, if the teacher calls or the principal calls the parent, we're in deep trouble, because we weren't able to speak out, but the respect that we had to give. So, as you said, these people should be held on a higher standard and they should be penalized more if they fail.
Exactly. There's a role model in the community, and that's people are taught and should be taught to look up and be respectful. And I mean, that's how my kids are raised, and whether they agree with it or not, that's their raised to respect teachers, respect, you know, people who work in the community. There's anybody, an adult, period, but, I mean, my kid's oldest is a teenager, but, like, you know, anybody in a position who is of authority, they are taught to respect them, regardless if they agree with it or not. That's, you know, you respect. And,
you know, I was talking to a lawyer a couple of weeks ago, at least trying to talk to her. This lawyer was screaming on the phone. You know, it's almost as though they weren't taught to respect people that are trying to talk respectfully. And sometimes we get into these positions where we're trying to talk to an individual in with some kind of title, some kind of influence or whatever, and they, whether it be because they've had a bad day or whether it be because they've heard something negative, I don't know. But when we're talking, I'm talking like I'm talking right now. When I'm talking to a professional, professionally, I'm hoping that they will be professional enough to respond in a professional way. But some of these people, like I say, they have psychological issues that are not being addressed. I don't care what title, what uniform, they are human beings.
Well, furthermore than that, you're not going to get much accomplished screaming at somebody, because at a certain level, people shut their ears off and they don't listen above a certain decibel. Like, the bottom line.
Yeah, then the focus is more on emotions than rational thinking and the message itself.
Like, when people yell, I tune them out at a certain level. I will talk back in a nice, calm, rational voice, and it drives people nuts. I'm sorry. When you're ready to talk to me in a calm voice, I will respond. And especially when people are flipping out, they don't want to hear that. But it's true. When you're calm and, you know, I will listen to you. I will talk to you in a calm and rational voice when you're ready.
When people don't know another individual and they're screaming at them like, what is going on? Why? And sometimes people just go off because they've had a bad day, as I say, or sometimes they go off because of something they heard about an individual. And it's not substantiated, and then there's no reason to be yelling at someone you don't know unless you actually have a reason and let them know what the reason is. You know, especially a lawyer, because they're dealing with people that are in prison that have been, as you say, falsely accused or that have been given harsh sentences, you know, that have been lied about by the media. And yet they don't even, usually it's guilty until proven innocent. I mean, innocent until proven guilty. And this, in the States here, it's guilty until proven innocent. And even sometimes that doesn't work.
You get far farther with people when you're not screaming at them. Yeah, negotiations and all that go much better when you're in a...
My mother used to say, you can win someone over with honey is better than vinegar or something like that.
Kill them with kindness.
Also thinking about when we talked about guards who have a role model, what I hear many times when I or read many times is that guards always talk about they are responsible for the safety of the community. That's their work.
Yeah.
And too less, or I don't know if I have ever heard it, it seems to be forgotten that guards are also responsible for the welfare of the incarcerated individuals. But that's what I almost never hear. I hear about responsibility only for the security of society.
I absolutely think that they are responsible for the welfare and safety as well of the inmates. That's why they're there.
They should be
in the psychological well-being, and I think that the prisons need to be, I mean, they shouldn't be so understaffed psychologically at, like, you know, and only have, you know, the psychological welfare during 9 to 5 at business hours. And I mean, unfortunately, from my experience in knowing some of the people that were guards at a couple of the prisons, like, they would be on the third shift and need to get psych services in there and not have the ability to get anyone on call, or take hours and hours and hours. And, you know, and they're not trained in psychology to deal with certain situations. And it was very scary for them. And they did actually care about the welfare of their, you know, these are the people on their block, or the people that, you know, they came in, and they, this one particular guard that I'm thinking of, you know, he did care about the people on his ward, and he, you know, looked forward to seeing them every day. And he was very humane in a lot of ways. And I remember him freaking out because he's like, I need somebody here and I can't get anyone. And, you know, it's third shift and there's no one on, you know, I can't get anyone in here quick enough, and freaking out. And it's not like a day shift. And, you know, it was,
but you know, the Massachusetts State Police Department was investigated a few years ago, and they actually the head person, they got in a lot of trouble because a lot of these state police were putting in for time they weren't working. They would have the others, you know, work replacing them, but they were putting in their own. So if there's a shortage of guards, sometimes it could be that other guards are putting in for time they're not working and getting others to cover for them. It can be pretty stressful.
Yeah.
But,
yep.
You know, as you and Mariam were talking about earlier when I had to take that break, you were talking about these kids in the communities, these kids growing up, and these kids in foster homes. And, you know, what you're talking about, when you talk about these kids, you're talking about these kids who are now many in prison.
Yeah,
you
know, very much.
And this is pretty sad, because even when they were in foster homes, they would act out so that they would get thrown out of that foster home into another one, because this is what they were so used to, being rejected by their families and then being rejected by foster homes. So they automatically would act out because they expected to be rejected.
Well, that, or they wanted, there were certain foster homes that you knew were not the greatest foster homes. I mean, I could tell you certain foster homes in certain communities that I knew that the kids would purposely get thrown out of, but I'm sure they're not foster families anymore, but I mean, this was a long time ago, but or they would want to get put in a residential facility, and they knew that the X number of throwouts from foster homes meant you got to go to residential. I mean, the amount of the tactics and the things that these, they're smart kids. I mean, that's the, I mean, if they, a lot of them had put their skills of manipulation and strategizing to better use, I mean, they'd be geniuses. But, you know, it's sad about what the broken homes and the broken families and all of that, that what these kids had ended up turning into and turning to on the streets, because there, a lot of them have brilliant minds, but unfortunately they turn to other things in life to get by. And because of broken homes, because of lack of supports in the community, because of lack of love, lack of role models, lack of family, lack of so many things. And eventually they just had lack of care about themselves, mental health issues that built up, and lack of anything. I mean, it was rage, anger, hatred, you know, hatred of society, hatred of people, hatred of everything. And it's a perfect storm.
You know what I find? You know what I find is they find their worth when they are in prison. They find their skills. They find their gifts, and that's why I always say they do poetry. The artwork is a lot.
The artwork is incredible.
And some have even written books, and this is all after they go to prison. And a lot of these people are rehabilitating themselves by doing all these things.
Which is why I think it's so important that a lot of them, you know, get the services that they need while they're there, because a lot of it is they were angry kids with nothing, and, you know, and, but then they see that they're coming out and then they freak. And this is what I saw a lot when I was working in mental health. You know, they did that also in inpatient and in residential. And then you'd see a release date coming up and they're like, oh God, I can't do it. I have everything I need here. I can't make it on my own. And they needed the, but yes, you can. The transition thing, you know, whether it be a group home, whether it be something, you can do this, and they don't have the confidence that they can do this. And that's, and then you'd see them, you know, sabotage, for lack of a better word, like everything because of that anxiety of, you know, of being on their own And that's what's so concerning. You know, they get out and they're out for a few weeks and they just freak out because this is not what, because they don't think they can do it. But they can if they're given the left chance and opportunity and, you know, and
confidence. I went on the internet one day and I typed in the oldest prisoners in the United States. Do you know that? And these are people that went in at a very young age. They're in their 80s and 90s. 80s and 90s. And I'm saying, why are they still in prison? And you were just saying a lot of them are afraid to come out because they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
A lot of them don't know where they'll go, what they'll get.
Yeah.
You know, type of, and no one will help in a lot of cases because everyone is afraid people come out of prison that they're going to commit crime again. But in 80s and 90s,
No, I don't think the 80s and 90s, but, I mean, there's a few who came out in their 70s, 60s or 70s, I don't know. But, you know, I think at that point, you know, there's a few who've, you know, have, did you interview them and they've, interviews have said, I mean, I think some of them have said I've never, should never be out of prison and they've done some really heinous things and, and that 70, 60, 70 years old, you know, okay, you know.
Leona, sorry to interrupt. Leona, I have to leave the show now.
Oh, okay.
I'm getting my kids home, so.
Mary usually comes on for an hour. I put it to an hour and a half because I had both of you on.
Yeah, that's okay. It's okay. You can continue, of course, together. So it was nice to talk to the both of you again.
Nice talking to you again. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you too, and Leona too. And we'll speak later. Okay. You have
Look
a great talk.
Hopefully next week.
Yeah. Okay. That's okay.
Schedule's been very busy lately, but hopefully we'll have you back on next week. Next Wednesday.
Yeah, I hope so too. Okay, thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
So, I don't know.
You were talking about something in when Mariam was getting ready to leave, and I'm sorry you got broken off.
Oh, no, I just said I think there's certain severe cases, like, and I think that monitoring when you're would just be a lot of work. I think in certain extreme instances, like certain specific offenses, I won't go into detail, but I think with their 70, 80 and they've proven to be too much of a danger, I think, you know, when you've come up and they've said, basically, I'm a danger, I'm a threat, and you know, are they proven it in prison that they're not safe to be in the community? But I think that's, again, it's a case-by-case basis. It's something that, I mean, there's people that, some people, for whatever reason, that will never be fit to come out, but I don't think that's everybody, and I don't think I think it's a case, a specific, you know, but I don't know what 80.
As you mentioned, there's a lot of wrongfully convicted in the prison, but there's not enough Barry Shecks. There's not enough innocence projects out there to help wrongfully convicted.
And I think that there's so much and there's not the money and there's not enough, unfortunately, I don't even know the answer to that. There's so many, I mean, I know colleges are taking it on, some of the colleges as, you know, projects and stuff, but I mean, the numbers, if you looked, I mean, and it's mostly convictions through the 80s or mid-90s. I mean, you think when DNA started being used in the courtrooms was probably the early 90s. It didn't get popular till OJ, really. People didn't really know about it. By the late 90s, it was pretty much used. So, but really, until I would say the 2000s was, I would say that was when CSI came in and people started, the courts really and the public started becoming aware of it. You know, I was talking about CSI effect, and that's when people started, you know, juries, I think, started becoming a little more aware of, you know, what, and kind of holding the state to a higher bar of what, you know, they needed for reasonable doubt, as yeah. opposed to before that, you know, they could sit there and talk legal or, you know, forensics, and people would be like, uh-huh, whatever, you know. But now, I think after maybe about 2000, early 2000, people started understanding what they were talking about, therefore making things a little harder to making the bar a little harder and making it reasonable doubt a little more more the standard for it a little higher, therefore preventing some wrongful convictions. I think a lot, you know.
You know, when I think about these other countries, though, there I know that there's got to be more violent in other countries as well, but yet they don't have the problems we have. They don't have the problems we have with mass incarceration. The recidivism rate is very, very low. And so there's something that we're missing. And I don't know what it is, but there's something that we are missing in this country that's preventing successful releases. And recidivism.
I think it has to do with the rehabilitation, how we do rehabilitation and or don't do it in our case. And lack of it. I mean, you said something about putting services in before crime prevention. And I think that we've made an effort to do that, but I don't think we've done it in the right way. And I don't know how to do it, but I don't think we've done it effectively. I know that, like, there's programs in, you know, in areas where there's a high crime rate, but trying to reach those kids that commit crimes is hard. And trying to make them participate in programs to prevent future crimes is hard. And it's really hard to do that until they've actually committed a crime and you force them into it. Because without that, people aren't going to want to, they don't want to participate.
I think the first thing they need to do is to bring back the ability for these kids that drop out of high school to be able to go into the military. I really believe that they should.
Oh yeah.
Because it worked in the past years.
Yep.
They were school dropouts, went into the military and came out as officers. And
yeah.
That's what they need to bring back.
I don't know if Massachusetts still has this, but they had a good program for kids who didn't want to finish high school, and they would go to trade school instead of high school. And they went to their classes in the morning and they went to a trade school, and they went and got a trade by the time they graduated. I mean, I know that other states in the country don't have a program like that, but that prevents a lot of people from dropping out because they
exactly.
all of a sudden have a job when they turn 18 and they don't have to drop out of school. I mean, there's so many alternatives to kids who don't want to get a traditional college education.
I will say Barnstable in on Cape Cod.
Yeah.
The Barnstable High School had a vocational at the time.
I'm very familiar with it.
Okay, they built my house back in 1972. It was a 3-bedroom home, but throughout the years, I added a bedroom, more bedrooms, and a living room, kitchen, and the basement, and everything. Mm-hmm. But they built my home. And it was $11,000 just for the material at the time. They didn't charge for labor. These kids had hands-on. I sold my house very cheap when I did sell it 27 years later. But the people that bought it from me sold it the following year for $250,000.
Yeah.
Now, they stopped. My house was the last house that they built on Cape Cod. Now, I say all the time, in the cities of New York, in the cities of Boston, where these places are dilapidated. These buildings are torn down.
Yes.
They need to be renovated. Take these kids, as you say, let them go out and let them do this as a trade and give them a stipend or something for the work that they do, and let them get that hands-on, because now they don't have if they don't have the vocational training or these trade schools, these kids are not going to want to go to school. If this is what they're looking to be, a carpenter, electrician, a mason, you know, masonry, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, they had it in Peabody. They had it in Medford. They had it in Salem. Like, They had a whole culinary arts program in Salem. They had a whole hair and cosmetology program. They had HVAC. They had a car. You used to be able to drop your car off and get your car fixed at the high school. And
exactly.
They had everything. Like, those kids walked out, and many of them had, you know, learning disabilities or were in the special education program, and they took their core classes in the morning, and they went to the tech school in the afternoon, and Peabody had a big program. Like, yeah, they all, and, you know, they went out, and they graduated at 18 and could get hired immediately, certified. And
These are the things that would prevent people from going out and committing crimes. They'd have, they would want something that they enjoy doing, something that's going to help them and help others at the same time. Clean up the streets, clean up a lot of these areas that where these buildings are. There's a building in Brockton. I remember years ago, I was hoping to get that donated to us. The windows are all busted out. It was a huge, huge bitch. You could actually build an organization inside for where you could have all kinds of offices, a gym, a spa for these individuals coming out of prison to have the counseling, you know, have all these different and that building, and this was years ago, and that building is still sitting there with those busted out windows.
Really?
Just being wasted.
I mean, but these kids feel good about them. Like, they're confident. They feel good about themselves. Like, I mean, it's just a huge, when they want to do well and they want to be successful, they're not going to try to mess that up. Like, 90% of them are going to want to be, you know, when they feel like they're doing good and they're going to do well, confidence level goes up. They're less likely to go out and do something stupid, for lack of a better word, you know?
Exactly.
And it's just, I mean, and that's the kind of things almost like you would want to, I mean, well, I could see where they wouldn't do it with incarcerated individuals, some certain programs, but almost putting that tech sort of school in a prison to give kids, I mean, kids, give some individuals some job sort of job training so they have something when they get out, especially if they know that they're going to be released. I mean, that's the kind of thing, education, job training, convoke training, something. So when they get out, they don't feel like they're, what am I going to do? You know?
That's another thing. At one time, I don't know if you would remember this job partnership or the CEDA program. They had that years ago. I think it was President Reagan that got rid of it. But that was a program, the CEDA program, where people that either dropped out of school or they were in the communities, they were of low income, they didn't have jobs, they would be able to get jobs, and the businesses would pay so much and the government would pay so much that these individuals, they work for counseling agencies, they work for even social services, they data entry operators, and a lot of them were doing all these jobs where they were getting promotions as well. The CEDA program was let go. So all these programs that you and I are talking about right now, are programs, had they been left in effect, if they had been left to this day, there would be a lot of people, I'm sure, that would not even be in the prison.
Yeah.
You know, they wouldn't be in the streets. They'd have these places to go to that were positive.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's just a lot that could be done. I mean, younger, like youth on to like help prevent, you know, crime in a perfect world. So, you know,
they need to bring back.
Yeah. Like some of the GED programs, and I mean, just education, college isn't for everybody. I mean, even giving teachers need to be able to identify. I mean, and this is some of what I did when I worked for in Lowell, was helping some of the teachers of the kids who are high risk and helping them just ways to help build self-esteem in kids you knew that were having a hard time and, you know, we're having trouble learning. I mean, I'm like, make them a leader in the classroom. Like, just giving strategies to kids you know that might be high risk to act out, just to deter, like, self-confidence and that. Just being able to as a somebody in the community, be able to pick out the kid that looks like, or you know, that's struggling, and start early and give them, you know, little jobs where they're a leader and positive reinforcement and that sort of thing, because even that can go a long way. It really can.
And I know adults, even adults that are in professional arenas, I know a lot of them that are they have low self-esteem.
Yeah.
They don't come out and say it, but you can tell in the way in which they do things. And a lot of times people in the communities, they need to look at body language too, because sometimes people that have depression, even people will be walking around with their heads down, you know, with their arms just going back and forth. And people that are depressed are not going to talk about their depression because they don't realize how serious it might be. And a lot of times this depression can go either way. It can go to suicide or it can go to homicide. We just don't know.
I think people need to be mindful of people in general and just being kind to people is kind of, you know, even just saying hello or asking, you know, how are you? Just even little gestures, saying hi to somebody you don't talk to very often, just saying hi or how's your day? I mean, going out of your way to say hello to someone is, you know, it's a little gestures, but all of a sudden it could mean a lot to somebody who's having a really bad day. And
it goes a long way.
It does.
People don't take into effect. I'm not saying it takes a skill. It doesn't take a skill to help others and to know how to interact with others. It takes a gift. It takes a heart. You know, it's the individuals themselves. As I say, not all people that work in the law enforcement and the prison system, they're not all bad. They're afraid to speak up against those who are the ones that are the problems. But those that are the problems also have some kind of insecurity or some kind of, you know, criminal behavior themselves. And this is where they need help as well.
Yeah, and I don't know. I can't speak to what sort of in-services they do within the prisons, but I think that they need to, I mean, it's a stressful job, I get that, and I don't know if they address the mental health of the staff as well as the mental health of the prisoners, or if it's addressed enough. I can't speak to that, but if it's not, it should be addressed. I mean, everyone says, you know, they look out for the mental health of the mental health people. Well, we need to look out for the mental health of everybody in lots of professions, not just mental health care workers or social workers, but people who work in any high stress position. And working with incarcerated individuals is definitely a high stress position. And I don't know. I mean, I used to have to supervise my clients at least once a week, but sometimes it came to frequently more than that. If they had a really rough day or whatever, you know, I had, you know, if clients were acting out, you know, I had to meet with my staff. I had staff that some were needed a lot more attention, and, you know, but then that on top of me, you know, I had to go, we had to all meet with people, and that was how we worked. And I don't know how it works in the prisons, but it sounds like they all need to sit and meet with people too. I don't know if they do, but if they don't, they should.
Exactly. I think that's what's lacking. I think they'd have a lot more positive response from those incarcerated if they were to take time out. You know, like in Norway, and even like with Marion, what she was saying, a lot of times these guards kind of like, they'll talk. They'll stop and they'll talk to the prisoner. They'll address them by their name and not a number.
No, yeah.
These things go a long way. They really do.
I told you I had a close friend who was a guard in Massachusetts, and he took his job very seriously, and he was very friendly with the prisoners, and to the point where we would be out and he would see them after they got released on the streets, and they were always very friendly. And I mean, so I know he did good. He was well liked in his position, but he was also very, he had connections, you know, positive connections with the inmates. And, but you know, I know he got stressed out, you know, when something happened, he would get worried, and he, you know, he, I don't know, there's a lot of them that develop positive relationships with the men on the ward in a good way and, you know, advocate for them and stuff like that. So they're not all bad. But
no, I hear
it's a stressful position. I mean,
yeah, I do hear from the incarcerated, a lot of incarcerated individuals that will say, you know, some of the guys that they liked, some
yeah.
of the guys that have been helpful and some of the guys that have been good with them, well,
yeah.
they also express, you know, the concerns
oh.
of others.
Oh, yeah.
Are,
I mean, I heard stories vice versa as well. I mean, I heard both. But, you know, I mean, but it, I mean, it was nice to know that, like, you know, we'd be out to eat and he'd be like, who are that? Oh, just one of the guys that was on my floor. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, that's all good. You know.
How
at least they're
this?
Saying hi. Could be worse.
Social workers, they had quite a bit of that burnout time too. I remember
exactly.
A lot of social workers would come on. I was with DSS for 14 years, but
yeah.
a lot of them would come on and they'd be on for like a year or 2 years, and they would be gone because of the stress related to even social work can be because we're dealing with a lot of dysfunctional people.
Yeah. Oh
and
yeah.
Just as they are with the incarcerated. But the burnout period is, the burnout time sometimes was really great. It was.
I would work with them that some of them didn't even stay on 90 days. So, like.
Yeah, really?
I would call and be like, where's so-and-so social worker? Oh, she left. Okay. I mean, like, who's the next one?
Really?
You know, I have kids who are like, I don't know who my social worker is. Okay. I have a kid at the hospital. I need to find their social worker. I don't know who their social worker is. We'll have to call a supervisor. Their social worker's left again. Okay. Oh, we'll wait and find the next one. Find someone on call.
Now, those that are incarcerated, too, there's another thing a lot of people don't realize. There's a lot of people with the same names.
Yes.
In the facilities, and sometimes they're confused because people will hear about one prisoner and they'll assume it's the person has committed the crime of another prisoner with the
yes.
same name. But I noticed there's a lot of people incarcerated in the United States. There's a lot of them with the same name. And if
yes.
they're in if they're in the same prison or the same block or the same unit, it can
yes.
cause be a problem.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Especially if someone's angry at if there's gang related or if someone's angry at somebody and yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And that's how yeah. people prisoners should not be stereotyped because every situation is different.
Yeah.
Every
I
situation.
Mean, especially if you don't know why. I mean, there's a, like crime is complex. You don't know what really provoked it, what didn't provoke it, and what the circumstances were around it. And it's not like someone's going to sit and tell you the history of, you know, it's, I mean, it's almost like I said about that video, like I can't comment and really until I know the whole story. I mean, I'm reading, like I was reading bits and okay, when I see them calling it like this and then, you know, from news footage clips, I can sort of make an assumption, but, you know, what gets put on
it. I appreciated when you said that because people in society don't do what you did. When you said that, it goes to show you that's professionalism. You said, I don't want to make comment until I know more about it. And you went
yeah.
on and it up. A lot of people just assume. And you mentioned yourself, the media sometimes is not really
no.
all. So more people need to take some advice and take a look at what you just did earlier today. And they need to start doing the same thing, is making sure that they know.
I'll take, you know, what I see, which was quotes from the, you know, the police department. When they call it that, well, I'm going to assume, okay, well, then they're going to launch an investigation. But, I mean, I've seen the media blow up, and this could be somebody who was arrested for something, you know, and the media can twist it and show only the worst possible parts. Now, you know, is that really what I want to make my assumption off of? No, because you don't know what the before and after was, you know. We don't know what happened. So if that was my client, for example, I wouldn't want to make an assumption because I don't know what provoked it. So, you know, I would want to be sure before I made a comment what happened, you know. And, like, I think people need to be leery about what's posted on social media just because they don't know the whole story. And so, like, that's just, you know, And exactly. Even what gets reported in the newspapers, and it depends on what channel you watch, and it depends on so many sides post different views that, like, there's 27 views of one story, and you got to sort of how in the middle figure out what the truth is. And before you jump to, you know, a conclusion, and somewhere in there is a truth, but, like, you know.
There's an author. His name is Casey Sherman, and Casey uh-huh. wrote. He wanted
he was
to write an
attorney.
Article. No, Casey Sherman is a. He's a an author.
Wasn't his, he an attorney?
Oh, there might be one with the same name.
Okay,
Casey,
all right.
Casey Sherman, his aunt during the Boston Strangler. His aunt was one of the nurses. As a matter of fact, Mary Sullivan. She was the last person.
Yeah, I know exactly who she is.
To be killed as a matter of fact, she was one grade ahead of me in school.
I lived in the apartment building next door to on Park Drive when they were reinvestigating that in the 90s.
Oh, geez. I went to Boston. I was going to nursing school.
Uh-huh.
And one night I got off the train and I was walking home and a taxi cab driver stopped and asked if I wanted a ride. So, you know, I took it because I was only like maybe within walking distance, well, about a quarter of a mile from where I lived. And he started asking me all kinds of questions about my husband and everything. And I said,
oh, wow.
can you please stop? And I jumped out real quick because
yeah.
I remember what was going on back then.
Yeah.
But I didn't expect, you know, to have a taxi. But anyway, I dropped out of nursing school. I wasn't there for more than 2 or 3 months. I dropped out and I ended up moving back to the Cape. But Casey's aunt had been the last victim of the strangler. But
yeah.
he wanted to write an article on someone he went to school with, someone he knew. And he put in the newspaper article that he wrote, you know, the person was a good person, never involved, in trouble or anything. But he said that we double dated together. And that person he was talking about double dating with, they never hung out with one another. They both played football together in the school.
Okay.
They knew one another from school, but they never hung out with one another.
Yep.
But yet that statement can cause a lot of problems because then people say, well, this person in court, he was known not to ever have been in a relationship.
Exactly.
And they caused problems. And that was never, taken out.
Taken out, so yep.
When questioned, he said, oh, he was talking about his friend of his
mm-hmm.
by the name of Annette. So if that was the case, take it out because people are going to discredit the person that's telling
exactly.
the truth.
Exactly.
These are the things that happen. So we never know. We never know what's truth and what's not truth unless we dig deeper. As Marianne says, deeper justice.
Yeah.
We have about 2 minutes left, so I want you to finish up and, you know, tell the audience what you think should happen, and just we'll end this with your comments.
Okay. Well, to recap, I think that more education needs to be put back into the school systems. I think what we were talking about with tech programs in high schools, maybe to educating the youth so that they have a more self-esteem. Not everyone is on a fast track to college. So I think if people graduate with more education and more certifications to contribute to society, they might not get lost and be committing crimes at a younger age, and they have confidence and skills to go out and get employment across the country. I think that's one thing that we could do to help prevent crime. I think recapping how we treat inmates, for example, maybe if it's not done already, making sure that employees inside the prisons, the guards, the supervisors get whatever mental health needs met that they're not getting, if they're not getting it right now, more supervision, more meetings, mental health, so they're able to vent and to express their feelings and be able to be more compassionate towards inmates and listen would be one way that we could be more effective. I think that's probably the two main points I would like to get across. So thank you. I like your idea.
I really like your idea as far as these trade program, trade schools. And I hope everyone in the audience will listen to what they've heard today and will try to help in some positive way. Contact the school system. Contact the legislative members. Contact the government, the governor, and talk about ways to have programs for these dropouts, these school children that are dropping out. Talk to them about opening, having more facilities established for these kids before they get into trouble. There are so many things that we can be doing. We can be helping with employment for them. We can be helping with vocational training for them. And while at the same time cleaning up the streets, if these kids go into these programs, these vocational programs, and they have their teachers, their carpentry teachers, their electrician teachers, if they have all these supports with them, it'll bring them closer together and at the same time improving the community and at the same time teaching the skills, the job skills that these students that are dropping out or even those that are still in school need to have. Jen, thank you for so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for all the insight that you have put into this, and I really appreciate it. And I hope that you'll be back with us next week. Everyone,
yes.
Jennifer, Jen Mather, please look her up on Facebook or whatever. Connect with her next week when she comes on the show. Listen to her ideas because they are very, very beneficial to not only those that we are dealing with in the system, in the prison system, but it may be also beneficial to you and your families. Thank you all for joining us, and we will be ending this episode now. Jen, thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.